Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And it's good to be back. When I'm not here for a week, it's just a little odd coming back, and it's always right to be here again, especially when I'm coming back to a wonderful guest, and that is Beth Keppert. Beth Keppert has been busy. She's the award-winning author of 4 narrative nonfiction books and writes for many of the top publications, including The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Book World, Chicago Tribune, The Atlantic, Health, Red Book, Real Simple, Organic Style, Madison, Child, Salon. I could go on and on. She has had her work anthologized in Lonely Planet's forthcoming Kindness of Strangers, Best American Sports Writing 2003, Best American Sports Writing 2001, the New York Times Writers on Writing book, not in any way related to this show, Mothers Who Think, Salon.com, Wanderlust, and The Leap Years, and she's been a guest lecturer and workshop leader at numerous venues. Her short stories appear in more than 30 literary journals. Oh, she does so much more, and because I want to talk with her instead of spending the next half hour reading her bio, I'm just going to say hi, Beth.
Hello there. How are you?
Gosh, you have so much going on.
Well, sometimes it feels like that, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, your most recent book is, of course, another just wonder, Seeing Past Z, published by Norton. Will you talk about this book and how it came about?
Oh, this book, as is the case with a number of my books, didn't begin as a book. It began as a series of fragments that I was writing for myself and for my son. I use my writing as my form of photography. If I want to stop my life and see it, hold it, keep it, have it to return to, I put it down on the page with words. And in this case, I began to write about the times I was spending with my only child, Jeremy, who's 9 when the book begins and is 14 when it's over, and I was observing his imagination. It was evolving. He was moving from a stalwart non-reader to someone who was starting to get interested in stories, stories that he liked to listen to, not read yet. And then he began to express an interest in patterns and sequence and metaphor, and then finally reading to himself, and then finally writing first short stories and then screenplays and that sort of thing. And I was very interested in how his imagination was evolving, and I was writing it down. And at the same time, I was interested in the world in which I live, and I live in a place that where there's a lot of competition amongst kids and not a lot of room to just daydream and imagine. And so I was measuring our lives against the lives that we encounter where we live. And it became a series of essays, some of them published in places like Child Magazine or the New York Times or Washington Post Book World or Chicago Tribune. And over time, it was clear that I was writing about the same issues. And my editor, Elaine Mason at Norton, thought that this was a book. And so it became one.
Do all of your books happen that way? You have four books of narrative nonfiction. Did they all come about like this in terms of you writing it first and then seeing the book? Or did you ever think, this one's a book, and I'm going to start, and I'm going to, you know, do a few chapters and a proposal? And
I don't think I'm brave enough to do it the latter. I am just writing what's in front of me. I give myself room to walk away. I don't give myself that project. And the times that I do, frankly, Barbara, I fail. When I say to myself, I have a novel, and I know its beginning and its end, its tension, its high point, its characters, and I know what it is, and I foolishly talk about it with friends, and I foolishly send out early chapters as if I know I can complete it. It never happens. All of the books have been different. Slant of Sun started very much, my first book started in the way that Seeing Past Z did. My second book, Into the Tangled Friendship, was a problem that I was chewing on for a while. I was really trying to understand what friendship is, what friends are, what are the responsibilities. And in order to talk myself into some kind of understanding, I kept writing up against that. Didn't publish much of that book before as essays. It really was, I guess, three-year process in trying to answer that question. My third book, Still Love in Strange Places, which is about my husband and about marriage and about his home country, El Salvador, actually began as a novel. The research for that book went on for 15 years. I was trying to write a novel because I thought it would help me understand who my husband was, where he had come from, why I still felt like a stranger when his family is here or when I'm there with him. It didn't work as a novel because I ultimately don't know enough about Salvadoran life to write it with knowledge. But I do know how to write about being a stranger in El Salvador. And so all of that research, all of that passion, that book really was the book that took the most of my life. It had been worked on for years and years before it became what it did. It started out as poems, went to fiction, and ended up as a memoir.
Interesting. Well, in your books, you do what people write fiction for, that you reveal so much of your life and just so much personal stuff that, how is that for you? I mean, you're obviously not thinking, that, okay, this is going to be a book, so I better watch what I say here. You're writing, and...
You know, it's really funny. I think, well, I'm not writing about sex, and I'm not revealing anything negative about the people that I know, and I'm not telling secrets. And so I feel that I'm on the safe side of it all. The intimacy, I think, is in the language, which I can't stop myself. That's just the way I write. It's not something I strive for. It's the way I think, the way I feel. But it is after they're published and after they're reviewed that I realize how personal the books are and how much they've invited the reader into my life to walk around, to sometimes stomp around, to sometimes gaze, and to assert opinions. And so that always takes you back. And it takes me back when I'll meet someone or I'll get letters from people who have read my books and they send me photographs of their children and they send me very, very, very long letters. There's one on my desk that I still have to answer. I just realized when I said that. And they feel this, they feel this shared intimacy, this opened door. And I think I understand how personal it all is when I read the letters I get back and I see how personal they are towards me, you know, towards what they want to tell me about their own lives. I don't know how to stop myself from doing that, and I think I'd be a better fiction writer if I could put it in the fiction. It's just what comes out. And I do take, I am measuring the distance always between what I write and how those I write about will feel about it. So I'm really careful about that. I don't just simply go on and But I think it's the way I write about my own feelings that is so personal.
Well, you have written quite a bit of fiction, or quite a bit of short stories. And what happens when you go into that head? Or again, does a piece begin and you find that it's becoming a short story? Or does an image or a line or something come to you and you know that that's what it is?
I haven't written a short story for quite a long time. I wrote about 30 short stories early in my career, and I loved that. Those stories were not sort of disguised fiction. Those were really created characters, created scenes, not from my life. I loved being there. I felt expanded. My imagination was expanded. I felt like a more empathetic human being because I was thinking outside my own head. And what gets caught in my, whereas it's a good thing, I think, to dwell in memoir about thoughts. People who are reading novels, and especially those who are reviewing them for the most part these days, are really looking for action, not so much interior thought. And so, whereas the one is just right for memoir, the other is not so right for much of the reading public. And I don't mean to generalize, but much of the reading public's looking for more action. Where I am in my own head right now, I have a fifth book coming out in March. It's very different. I think it's genre making and breaking and interesting for me. And I'm caught up in a lot of teaching and a lot of other things. But what I know about me is this. When I begin to write again, I'm starting over. I'm starting where I started at 9, which was with poetry. And I'm going to really, there's so much just pure poetry I want to write. And then I want to go back to the short stories, and I want to write them again. And I think we teach ourselves how to write. With every darn time we pick up the pen, it's something new. We're teaching ourselves to write. I want to teach myself to write again, better, and to use the stepping stones that I used before, and I want to see where it takes me.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Beth Kephart, author of Seeing Past Z, Nurturing the Imagination in a Fast-Forward World, published by Norton. Will you read to us?
I thank you for asking me to do this because, as I said to you earlier today on email, I haven't actually read from this book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to read right now just two paragraphs from early on in the book. And I've chosen these two paragraphs. I'll set them up a little because I'm looking at the imagination not just as reading and writing, but as how we read the world. Why does the imagination interest me? Why do I think it's an important thing for our children to have? It's because I think we can help them know themselves, know the world, be more empathetic towards it, have more compassion, make more intelligent choices. So it's not just here's a book, read it, see if you can write a good one. It's about reading the world, and so these are two paragraphs about reading the world. Can you read the world as you read a book? Can you see in stalks and cows and sheep and rock a telling narrative? Can you teach a child? Can a child teach you? In southern France, we have been thinking of Thoreau. It's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. We have been hunting for details, patterns, and surprises, making lists and trading them, reflecting on our capacity to bear witness, not just to the moon, but to the haunting power of the moon, not just to the dying of the sunflowers, but to the fact of so many embedded seeds, not just to the thick, stone, age-old houses, but to the way those houses come alive. I want Jeremy to grow up poking his fingers through the web of mysteries, hoping for the unexpected, taking pleasure or conviction or understanding from what he finds. I want him to build the bridges we all must learn to build between the world we are taught and the world we read about and the world we will only ever guess at. Curiosity bolsters knowledge, and knowledge feeds intelligence, and intelligence helps us navigate our lives. That is the way it works. And so we are here looking for the cloud of flour above a baker's shop, for the miniature dogs and the baskets of bikes, for the color of river water to change depending on the light, for the cows to crowd into shady wedges, for boys to head off with fishing poles, for the rain to come at night. We have gone from town to town in southern France, teaching ourselves to pay attention, to see the domestic and the sacred, the glorified and the wasted, the crumble of a castle, and the wedding in the street, reading the world as if it were a book, so that tomorrow or the next day, the stories we imagine, tell, act out, or write will pay homage right back to the world.
Thank you so much. That was Beth Kephart reading from Seeing Past Z. That is such a lovely passage.
Thanks.
Yeah, are you taking notes along the way? You know, I mean, like that piece, obviously you're writing about being in France. When you were there, were you noting
these things? I did have a journal. Yeah, in France I did have a journal. I often don't have the luxury of time to have a journal, but in that particular four-page overall or five-page chapter does reflect 3 weeks. We were in southern France, and the most of the chapter is about when we go beneath the earth and imagine what it was like to live there in this, you know, cave of stalactites and stalagmites. Yes, I took notes that night when I came back, but was I piecing it together? Did I know what it meant? No. I took notes right then while I was there about the cloud of flour above the baker shop, which we could see from where we were staying, about the river, and it would just be, they would be like lines of poetry, you know, a cloud of flour above a shop, and just on a page. And then I'd come back, and my handwriting is horrific. So half of the good stuff will need somebody with better eyes and interpretive skills than mine to even know what's in them. But then I really think about it, and I say, what was that? What was it adding up to? And that's what it did in that case.
I think, did you publish that in Salon?
Yes.
On Salon?
Okay. Yes, I did. And it was also part of Wanderlust.
Yes, okay. I recall seeing it somewhere, and I love how all of these pieces could be standalone pieces, and some of them are, and yet how there is a flow to the way the book is organized. It feels as though each piece was written in order.
Well, I would say, and this is a guess, but I think probably 7 or 8 of the many pieces, I don't remember how many there because they're short, are in here, were standalone, and the rest was really quite a lot of work, a lot of tearing out one's hair to make it work. Now, you have a lot of questions to answer when you're a memoirist. Are you going to write this in present tense and pretend it's all happening at the moment and get mm-hmm. that urgency? Are you going to give yourself that past tense and that ability to reflect on what it means? Are you going to talk about what else is happening in your life when all of this is going on? Or are you just going to hold the themes that you've held to? And as I've said in the past, but it's important, so I'll repeat it, I write to themes. My first book was What is Normal? How Do We Get There? My second book, the theme was, you know, what is friendship and how do the people who enter our lives shape who we become? The third book, Still Love in Strange Places, was how well can we ever really get to know a lover? And what happens when we work really hard at that? Do we lose an essential piece of ourselves? And in this book, it's, you know, does the imagination count for anything? Can it be taught? And does it matter in the world that our kids are growing up with? So if you hold to those questions when you get lost and when you're asking yourself, present or past tense, throw the story in, throw it out, it helps. But there was a lot of work that was done to Seeing Past Z. And the 8 or so chapters that reflect work that had been published in the Times or Salon or Chicago Tribune, those pieces were reworked to make them fit into the flow of this book. And some of the best writing got thrown away. It just wasn't fitting. It was just one beat off the given theme, and I didn't want to go there.
So in writing to theme, are you also writing, say, to an outline? Are you?
No, never an outline. Always to questions. It's philosophical. It's thematic. It's lyrical. I think about it as choreography. I was, as is clear in this book, a competitive figure skater when I was younger. And the thing I was best at, besides very big axles and double lutzes and stuff, but I was a terrible spinner. But I was really good at footwork. But the thing that I won were the competitions where they would play this music, and then you'd go into a soundproof room, and you'd have to hold that music in your head, and you have to come out and choreograph it on the spot. And that's what I did well, and that's what I feel I'm doing when I'm writing. I am choreographing. There are the held notes, there's the spread eagle, there's the big jump, there's the leap of faith. Each each book is a choreographed piece of ice skating for me.
Hmm. I like that. And I love that about you, that you were a skater.
I was a tomboy, Barbara. I mean, I was a skater in frilly dresses, but I was also, you know, the muddy, the only girl on the cross-country track team and the, you know, feisty little I was a sprinter and a tennis player, played squash. I was, you know, I was not really bound for the life of a writer, which is sitting in a room rather quietly. Mm. I'm very physical in the way that I move around the world.
Interesting. Speaking of moving around the world, what about touring then? What about book signings? What about promoting your work? How is that for you?
I don't do any of it. Actually, you're promoting my work, and I thank you for that. I've never gotten on a plane. Oh, no, that's not true. I did go out to San Francisco for A Slant of Sun as a family vacation, and then did some readings there. My agent's out there, Amy Rennard, and she had set up some fun things for me. But I've done a couple of local readings for some of my books. I did go to Washington and to Boston and New York for Still Love and Strange Places. That was the most, those three were the, that was the size of the tour for that, and that was very generous of Norton. There were no readings for Seeing Past Thee, but there's been really incredibly generous reviews by your own wonderful Susan Salter-Renders at the LA Times and Chicago Tribune and Baltimore Sun and elsewhere. I've been blessed by having people review the book who read it with generosity, without judgment. I've been blessed this time out. So.
What about that? What about reviews? You just in terms of over the last few books, the last four books, how have you learned to deal with reviews?
I first of all, for the first book, didn't expect any. It was a sort of a family book, and then, you know, it was nominated for the National Book Award, and then there were reviews after that. So the National Book Award was October or November, and that book came out in June, and it was very quiet up until then. That's just what I expected. You're never prepared. When they're really generous, you don't feel entirely deserving, to tell you the truth. I think what has bothered me, I've been very lucky, let's be frank. There's just been a couple over the four books that have readers haven't, enjoyed the books. But it's been very rare. I think what bothers me is if a reviewer gets something wrong. I mean, technically wrong, just even the facts are wrong in a big way. That was bothersome a couple of times, even if it's a stellar review. You think, oh, wow, it's kind of hard to have that in print. For the first book, as I said, I didn't expect any. With Into the Tangle Friendship, it's a second book. Sophomore books are tough. Your first book is your big moment, right? You know, everybody's watching that book, and then they figure after that you're on your own, baby. And if they really like the first one, they really hope to find something wrong with the second. That's just the way we are. I mean, I see it happen all the time. I review quite a bit. I review for the Chicago Tribune a lot and also for the Baltimore Sun, and I have reviewed some, not a lot, but for the Washington Post, did reviews. Couple for Salon, and a huge number of reviews for the now no longer in existence book magazine. I think being a reviewer helps me be a smarter writer. It also, I have a lot of empathy for any book that I'm reviewing. I know how hard they are to write. And I'm tough on a book when I feel the motivation has been off. When I feel it's maybe been sloppily put together or hastily done, when I feel that it was written for a purely commercial purpose, and therefore some decisions that don't make for good storytelling were made. But I'm an empathetic reviewer, and you know, to tell you the truth, for this book I asked not to be sent any of the reviews, and it's been my friends. the wonderful Susan Strait, who called me, and you too, to tell me about the LA Times Review. My friend Floyd Skloot told me about the Chicago Tribune Review. I try not to read anymore. I try not to look.
Interesting. When we come back, I have another question or two about reviews. So everybody out there, do not go anywhere. Just stay right there. Or actually, you can get up, get a glass of water, but come right back to your computer or to your radio. And if you're in a car, keep your eyes on the road and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have been here since 5 with Beth Kephart, author of Seeing Past Z, Nurturing the Imagination in a Fast Forward World, published by Norton. Hi, Beth.
Hello there.
I wanted to ask you something else about reviews. Well, a couple of things. And one is, why don't you want to read them
at this point? Well,
what happens?
I'm not sure they make me a better writer. If they're wonderful, I am very, very grateful. I'm hugely grateful. But I also don't want to be tricked into thinking I've written the perfect book yet, you know. If they're negative, I do agonize. I frankly do. I am one of those awful people who wishes she could please the world, and I'm disappointed if I've disappointed a reader. So, you know, it's just the way it is. I think that we get caught in the trap as writers of needing to know the response. And I do want to know what those I love and respect and my friends think about what I've had to say. Not so much as you know, Beth, you're a great writer. That's not what I want to hear. I want to have the conversation. As I said earlier, I'm interested in answering big universal questions, and I'm interested in the conversation and the dialogue, and I'm hoping that my friend Alex Kotlowitz or something will read parts of a book or an essay and say, you know what, I have a different point of view. I want to be broadened. So I want the conversation. I want the book to open a conversation. What is very fulfilling and gratifying, of course, is when, as I said earlier, readers enter your world and choose not to just judge it, per se, you know, as bad or good, but to consider it. And, you know, those are rare people, and boy, do I appreciate them. And I've been graced, pretty much, I would say, with my books to have reviewers like that.
So how do you prevent yourself from looking?
You know, I just don't, because it's not like I'm holding a hand over my eyes. it's just not part of what I want to fill my world with. I want to be a better person. I want to be a good mother and a good wife and a good writer. And I'm trying to teach myself to care a little less about what people think. And again, that is not to say that I'm not hugely grateful when generous things are said.
Sure. It just seems that, you know, especially with accessibility to reviews online and everywhere else, that it's just so tempting, you know? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, not checking your email. Sometimes you have to prevent yourself from doing it.
I don't. I mean, for example, with the L.A. Times Review, Susan Strait called me on July 4th. The fireworks are going off outside my window, and she's reading me this review, and I'm amazed and grateful and overwhelmed, and most of all, very happy to share it with a friend. But if it were online, I don't think that I would have gone in and looked for it and read it, you know. It would have been a sort of frightening, lonesome experience. Is it good? Is it bad? What's the next line I got to say? But to have a friend there do it was really great. And the same thing just happened, as I said, on Sunday with the Tribune.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes when I read reviews, and you said earlier that, you know, what bothers you most of all is reviewers getting the facts wrong. I wonder sometimes if they've even read the books. Or if they've kind of looked online to see what else has been written about it, maybe read the promo stuff. And
yeah, a lot of times it does sound like that, doesn't it? But you can tell when a reader's been engaged. And it's not the only measure, Barbara, and neither are book sales. And it has to do, I think, at the end of the day, did a book succeed if it changed a couple points of view, if it made things happen that weren't happening before. And in the case of this recent book, Seeing Past Sea, what's been terrific is to hear from the few folks out there who are saying, guess what, I read your book, I think what you're saying is important, and I'm going to start a writer's workshop where I live, and I'm going to see what happens with kids. I'm going to experience that. That is the success of the book. Because if 10 people do that, if 12, that's 120 kids, say, who have been given an opportunity they wouldn't have been given before. You know, books provide you, as well, as you know, with a platform. And in this case, it's been my platform to kind of go out there and write a couple of op-ed pieces about how we raise our children, about whether the imagination counts. That I don't know whether I would have had the room or been given the space to put those thoughts forward. And in the case of Seeing Past Sea, what has it done? Well, you know, I've had workshops in my house with kids for 4 or 5 years, and they've been kids that could locally drive to the house, and they've been wonderful experiences, and I write about that in Seeing Past Sea. But with Seeing Past Sea was coming out, I was given the opportunity to move my workshop to this glorious garden, Chanticleer. And I was able then, with the support of the staff there, of course, and with their financial support, to actually get great vans and bring some kids in from the city and thereby expand the workshop. And every year I teach totally different things, come up with totally different exercises, and there I had the chance to use a garden as a backdrop, a garden as place. Seeing Past Sea, I think, gave me that chance to do that. And what has that done then? Well, the kids from West Philly who came out to the suburban garden really loved what happened over the summer, and so did their parents, and word got out, and now what I'm going to be doing is teaching the teachers of the West Philadelphia schools how to bring creative writing into the classrooms. Could I have done that without Seeing Past Sea? No. Does it matter whether anyone buys the book? Well, I think that this is pretty cool to think, hey, you know, in more classrooms than there were previously, kids are going to get a chance to dream out loud and to express their ideas.
Yeah.
Great, 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 you know?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I'm remembering now when I started reading the book a while ago when it came in and I put it down so that I would be fresh when I talked with you, because we weren't going to talk for a couple of months, but when the book came in and I started reading it and reading about the Great Books program, the Great Books Foundation, which now is getting something going in my school.
Fantastic, yeah. You know? Yeah, and because of you, because of the work that you're doing there. And that's great. And I think it's, you know, it's a quiet book, but one that can change lives. I can't tell you how many people have written to me and for some reason felt liberated to give their children more room to dream because it's almost like the book was a permission slip. Wow, there's somebody else out there who's been worrying about these things. There's someone else out there who thinks that maybe that extra Japanese lesson could be replaced with a kid lying on his back looking up the clouds. I don't feel quite so lonely doing that. I'm going to do it. Well, fantastic, you know, fantastic. And that's what it's all about, I think.
We are talking to Beth Keppert today. Her book is Seeing Past Z, Nurturing the Imagination in a Fast Forward World, published by Norton. What about that? Why is it that that the imagination is under stressed and activities, full schedules, is overstressed? And what do you think about that?
You can't quantify it. And we are living in a world where increasingly, from very early on, kids have to be quantified, evaluated, sorted out, and, you know, put into the buckets of, you know, hyper genius, regular genius, you know, whatever, and then sort of had their, you know, the trajectory set for them. This is, of course, not happening in all communities across the country, but it's big enough to be written about quite frequently, the New York Times and elsewhere, and, you know, there's organizations like Putting Family First and Children's Defense Fund that are concerned about how kids are spending their time. You know, the National Commission on Writing, when I was working on this book, I didn't have any idea that there was a whole commission that was looking at how much time kids are spending reading and writing in classrooms. And, you know, you get from them statistics like fourth graders are spending less than 3 hours a week writing, and
yes,
that a large 75% of high school students never get a writing assignment from their history or social studies teachers. You know, you're getting this sense. And I firmly believe, and this is not just some writer talking, but that if you don't write, if you don't stop and say, what words can describe what I just thought, what I just saw, what I just experienced? You've not fully experienced it. Virginia Woolf said the same thing, of course, in a different way. But we are not giving our kids the chance to live, you know, fully realized lives if we don't encourage them or give them the tools or give them a reason to sit down and write about what's happening to them. And the other thing, this is sort of off here, but I'm on a tangent. I'm going to go.
Go, girl.
This is the sort of thing I would check if I were writing the book. The other misnomer is that, well, writing is isolating and all these activities are about social skills. And hell no, I say that writing is also, can be very much about community building. And that is why the workshops have been so crucial. Because you know, when I was working in fourth grade with the fourth grade kids and I was reading The Elephant's Child out loud, that was a reading out loud thing. But it was about rhythm and I was reading it and we were rocking and we were rolling in the classroom and it was a shared experience. And then as we've evolved as a class of kids that are moving forward and growing up, we've learned how to describe favorite hiding places, how to develop simile, metaphor, etc. We've done it in teams. We've done it together. And an example of that, at Chanticleer Garden this summer, there were 17 total kids. About 14 came each time. And the first time we met, divided into teams, and there were four. teams. There were those who were going to walk that garden, experience that garden for the first time as a group of musical notes. There were those who were going to experience it as an elephant. There were those who were a kite that had gotten lost and caught in a tree. And the last group was a group of a Swedish settler that was rafting through instead of walking the mat, you know, the path. Now, as teams, what did these kids have to do? They had to talk to one another. They had to create banks of simile, metaphor, situation, and plot. Walk that garden, take the 20 minutes, take notes, get a bank. The conversation was gorgeous because in my workshop, I had the privilege of working with a girl who had just moved here from India and an Egyptian boy and a girl from Iran and a girl who, you know, I mean, very different economic situations, a musician, a little girl who had a small part in the movie The Village. Very different kids were talking about the garden as musical notes or whatever. That is community building. Once they had their bank, they individually went home and wrote two different kinds of poems, which I won't bore you with what they were. But and then they come back and they critique them. And what happened over the summer? Yeah, they imagined. Yes, they learned the garden. Yes, they found their voices. All very important things. But they also learned each other's cultures, opinions. They had to look at each other, interview each other, find simile and metaphor in a garden for each other. They learned about each other. Writing can be about community. And I think that is one of the big messages in the book and one of the big things that we seem to be forgetting as we take our kids to all these activities that, you know, this too is an activity that's social.
Yes. Yeah. Read to us again.
Oh, okay. Well, I have it marked. And I'm going to read just a few more lines than I read last time. This is from the piece that I first published in the New York Times, but when I thought about reading, I think this is important. Writing is not easy. We all know that, and here I had this kid who never wanted to read, and then he finally got into reading, and then felt awkward with language, and then got into writing, and then suddenly he was passionate about being a writer. However, he got stuck, and then I felt this great guilt. I'm just going to read the opening page and a half of Surprise Endings. Jeremy is on the hunt for a surprise ending. He trails up and down the hallway, sighs, goes outside, paces the yard. It is October. The leaves have lately rained down from the trees, and as I watch him through the window, I feel the melancholy of the season, the melancholy of a boy whose own story cruelly eludes him. I can do little to help. I've already tried. We have sat with the sprawl of his long first draft between us, charting the story's terrain, hypothesizing plot. We have analyzed characters, settings, coincidences, motivations, the gaps between so many telling details. We have sketched out what-ifs with words and symbols. For weeks, he has worried his mystery along with a seriousness that has become its own brand of worry, with a singleness of artistic mind that has made me wonder what I was thinking when I first seduced him toward writing. At what price writing? Outside in the Chardonnay light of the fall, my son kicks at the leaves as he paces and grimly paces, while at this window I stand and consider all I fail to warn him about stories and their making. What kind of love is that, I ask myself, leading my only child into the lair of writing without equipping him for its demoralizing hazards? Language is stingy, I should have said. Plots don't always yield. You can learn the rules of framing form and voice, but rules do not make stories. And you can love your characters as you love your friends, but that doesn't mean that they'll return the kindness. And you can deny yourself the noise of life, but silence does not leech language. Stories are inside us, but they are also just beyond us, so that whatever you write, no matter how rare or good or true, will be subject to the scars of so much searching. Jeremy wants, he says, to shock his readers with his ending. He wants a Harry Potter-style aha in a book that festers with devious adults, white-collar crime. He'll use conspiracy theories and lurking twin brothers in multiple locales if he has to, but he won't be satisfied unless he hears in his mind's ear the collective gasp of his someday readers.
Wonderful. What changed, do you think, for him from the kid who didn't like to read to the kid that started to read, that started to love reading and writing?
What changed is we finally found the book that he could enter. And how cliche is it that that was Harry Potter? Wouldn't it have been brilliant if it were some like obscure title that only I would know because I'm a writer? But no, it was Harry Potter after we had tried everything else. And I think Harry Potter appealed to him because Jeremy in many ways looks like Harry Potter is described. He does have a scar. It's not on his forehead, but it's right in his hair, and you see it quite easily. But he has dark hair, big brown eyes, a glorious face structure. And he, when I was reading Harry Potter to him, he got it. He got into it. He started to ask questions of himself, you know, why are they like this, and why aren't they doing this for him, and why can't he do that? And so he wanted to know what happens next. Isn't that the whole thing in writing, what happens next? And the story got him. And then we moved on to the doll stories. Danny championed the world, and he really got those. And then he started to, because of his great librarian in his elementary school, got who Jeremy was, as this wonderful librarian gets who all the children are, and introduced Jeremy to the crazy, silly Wayside School stories, which were his to own, his to share with friends, his to laugh silly about. And I'd had just coincidentally and lovely opportunity. I'd met Lewis Sacker at the National Book Awards, and I had encouraged Jeremy to make a connection with a writer, and so Jeremy wrote to Lewis Sacker to tell him what he loved about the Wayside School, and he wrote back, and this was this revelation, because Jeremy had, you know, interacted with an author on the paper, and he'd learned something that, you know, only Jeremy would know because he was told it in a letter from the author. And it just, he got interested. How are these things made? And, of course, there were many exercises and things that we did here to make it interesting along the way. It wasn't, like, easy, but it happened.
Yeah, I love it. I just, you know, there is that point, and the point seems to be different for different kids. Before we go on, though, let me say that I am talking with Beth Kephart, author of Seeing Past Z, published by Norton. And I think of parents who complain that either their kids are not reading the classics, maybe they're reading Captain Underpants a little too much, or they're not reading what they think they should be reading. What do you say to that?
It depends on what they're saying. Sometimes I do worry about what kids are reading, and I worry about what's being written for young adults. So that's a whole other story. But I judged the national, I chaired that committee, the Young People's Literature, and I was quite distressed, frankly, by much of what I read that was being written for that audience. I think that it's all about, if you're having regular conversations with your kids, and they're not just disappearing into their room, to read and then coming back and sort of sulking and not talking to you about it. I do think that there's room for what they're interested in. Believe me, Jeremy's interests are far from what mine are or were at his age. He's interested in spy stories, adventure stories, mysteries, detective, you know, every Agatha Christie, you know, and I'm like, well, there's the Secret Garden. But, you know, it's his thing, and that's another big point in this book is we cannot direct our children into becoming the children we want them to be. We can and should lace their lives with questions, with opportunities to observe, with many things that help them decide and are guidance. But in the end, we can't dictate what books they read. But I think that we can fill their lives with lots of opportunities, and along the way, if it's good, they're gonna get that it's good, and they're gonna come along for the ride.
I recall you saying that you read some of this, or maybe all of this, to Jeremy, Seeing Past Z.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. What would happen? Would you write a piece and?
Often I was asking if it was accurate. Mm-hmm. I would say, "Hey, Jeremy. We had this conversation a couple of days ago. I'm remembering that it sounded like this. You know, is this your recollection?" And I'm talking about a kid who has an unnervingly brilliant memory. I mean, unnervingly so. Every night he says to me, "Today is September 6th. Exactly 6 months ago at this hour, we were talking about it." Oh, please stop, no more. Well, you know, so he knew whether it was accurate or not, so that was part of it. I wanted him to participate in the making the story of the book. And also, I wanted him to see how I was interpreting how we were living our lives so that he could have a chance to say, you know, I'm not reading it that way, Mom. It was just a story, you know, or am I investing too much in this moment? And it was a great chance for conversation. Jeremy really likes, it's not like Jeremy goes around thinking, I'm the subject of two books. He doesn't at all. We don't talk about me being a writer in this house. He certainly knows what I work on. I certainly say, is it okay if I publish this? Or, you know, how do you feel about this? But we're not talking about Mom's the author in this house. He knows, therefore, that there's a book out there called Seeing Past Sea. He knows basically what's in it, remembers a lot of the passages I've read, likes the cover, and is really happy that people like the writing of his that's in the book. He thinks that's cool.
That's great.
You know, I'll get these notes from people like, I love that poem. At the end. And he's like, really? Somebody read my work? Wow! You know? That's how he's published.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I love the book, obviously,
well,
and your writing is gorgeous in this book, as it always is.
Thank you, Barbara.
Do you have any, dare I say, words of wisdom for the writers listening who are trying to find their voice, who are trying to find their story?
Yeah, well, boy, it's hard to do that in a brief, and I don't even have a clock, so I don't know how much time we have left, but I teach memoir writing, of course, at, you know, across various local campuses for one day or 2 day workshops to adults. I talk about finding, you know, telling the story that urgently must be told and not just saying, I lived a life, I should write a memoir. I do talk about finding the questions that you want to answer. I talk about the difference between autobiography and memoir. And I think that the eye can drone, the eye can bore, the eye can, you know, parade. And I think the books that connect, or at least the books that I connect with, are those in which the author is saying, my life is the, you know, filter through which I try to understand how the world works, what's important in the world. How do you make the eye universal? How do you tell in, you know, with great, wonderful, the just right details, something particular, something that you remember, something about your life that has repercussions for, you know, and reverberations for the universe, or for someone who lives in China or someone who lives in Japan. What's been fascinating to me was some of my books that have been translated. The first one was translated, among other places, in Japan, to get letters from Japanese readers who say, you have written my life story. Well, that's pretty fascinating to me. And I think then that has to do with the right details, not telling somebody everything that happened in that five-year period, not thinking about it necessarily in a chronological fashion if it doesn't work that way, but what illustrates the profound questions I am trying to answer. That's the way I approach it. And that's probably because I haven't lived a startlingly interesting life. You know, if I'd lived some brave, around the world, living by myself with rhinoceros as my only friends, I might be writing, you know, more just about I. But as it is, I'm a citizen of the planet, and I am writing hoping to speak for some of us, raising questions that I feel urgently must be answered.
And doing a marvelous job.
Thanks.
I might add, thank you so much for
being on
the show again.
I love talking to you.
Well, it's great to have you, and come back when this becomes a paperback.
Oh, I don't know.
Or the next one.
I'll write and see if that's going to happen.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
That was Beth Kephart, author of Seeing Past Z, talking to us from Pennsylvania. And I should have asked for her website. If you want it, do write to me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net, and I will send it to you. She has a beautiful website. And as I said, Seeing Past Z is just an excellent book, excellent writing. What else can I tell you? My book is out, Pen on Fire. You can go to my website at penonfire.com and read all about it. Hear an audio excerpt even. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, that's where you go. Go to penonfire.com. From there, you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And what else? Oh, I mentioned the Great Books Foundation. Wonderful program for bringing reading into the schools, greatbooks.com. And if you want more information on that, go to their website, again, greatbooks.com. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Spalding Gray, who said, "The problem with regret is that it keeps you from living in the present." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week. Darling.